Today is April the 10th, 2019, and April 15, the tax man comes.
Normally, both federal and state income tax returns are due by April 15th, also known as Tax Day. According to IRS.gov, individuals who live in Maine and Massachusetts have until April 17, 2019, to file their 2018 Form 1040 because April 15, 2019, is Patriots Day and April 16, 2019, is Emancipation Day.
Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Is that product you bought from Amazon a counterfeit? You should find out. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet as well as on various podcasting hosting sites. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. For those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message with your question or comment to hank@pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on the Google number 862-800-6805. That's 862-800-6805, and you start your message with the Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. Major browsers to prevent disabling of click tracking privacy risk. Newer versions of Chrome, Safari, and Opera will no longer allow you to disable hyperlink auditing, which is a concern for those seeking maximum privacy. While some of these browsers previously allowed you to disable this feature, newer versions are going in the opposite direction. Hyperlink auditing is an HTML standard that can be used to track clicks on website links. This is done by creating special links that ping back to a specified URL when they are clicked on. These pings are done in the form of a post request to the specified web page, which can then examine the request headers to see what page the click came from. Most browsers will not let you disable this now in the future. With the privacy and online tracking being such a large problem and major concern for many users, you would think that browser developers would give you the option to disable anything that could affect your privacy. Unfortunately, this seems to be going in the reverse direction when it comes to hyperlink auditing. This flag no longer works with Safari 12.1. In the Chrome 74 beta and the Chrome 75 Canary builds, though, this flag has been removed and there's no way to disable hyperlink auditing. The upcoming Microsoft Edge Insider build, and as it's based on Chromium 75, there's no way to disable hyperlink auditing on that browser either. Like Edge, Opera is also based on Chromium, and the Opera 61 developer build removes the option to disable hyperlink and auditing as well. What this means is that starting next month, when Chrome 75 is released to the stable branch, the Edge, Chrome, Opera, and Safari browsers, they will no longer offer a way of disabling this tracking feature and privacy risk. Only Brave, which many of you have not heard of, but I've been working with it, and Firefox currently disable it by default and do not appear to have any plans on enabling in the future. Firefox 66, Firefox Beta 67, and Firefox Nightly 68 disable hyperlink auditing by default and allows users to enable it using the browser send ping about config setting. It turns out that Google uses hyperlink auditing in their search result pages. Every time you click on a search result link, your browser will also send the request back to a Google URL in order to track the click. Hey, Firefox is now my browser of choice, and as Google has withdrawn my choice for disabling of click tracking. I hope that anyone is using a browser that they understand that you're being tracked. And if you don't like it, well, it's your decision to use another browser. I guess Facebook, now with much publicity, has now stopped asking new users for email passwords. I can't believe that they've been doing this, and they haven't stopped until just recently because of all the flack. Facebook has halted a sketchy practice of asking some new users for the outside email credentials in order to verify their accounts. In a shared screenshot of a Facebook user showing that they were asked for the password also for the email, the social media giant now faces intense criticism from security professionals. A spokesperson for Facebook said that it will no longer now engage in this practice. Okay, you said it. Let's see you stop it, because in the past, what Facebook said that they will do, they really haven't followed through in many cases. Facebook has maintained that the password prompt only appeared for a small number of users. Specifically, new users who were signing up for Facebook on desktops with email addresses that did not support OAuth, which is an open standard security protocol used by Google, Amazon, Twitter, and Facebook, and let users grant third-party clients access to their information without giving them their password. Engadget tested the company's claim on Tuesday and that it no longer asks for email password, and it checks out, so I guess we have to accept it. They said that they signed up for a new Facebook account with iCloud email address, which doesn't use OAuth, and Facebook then sent a 5-digit security code to that iCloud email. It also sent a separate email with a Get Started link, both of which could be used to get into the new Facebook account. But crucially, it never asked for the email account password. Facebook is facing more scrutiny over how it handles user passwords after numerous privacy transgressions over the past year, while the social media giant is also quick to fix whatever initial problem occurs. The fact is, new problems always keeps cropping up. If a 3,000-word manifesto released last month by CEO Mark Zuckerberg on a new privacy-focused vision for the company is to believe, the company wants to take privacy seriously from the top down. But the recent evidence isn't too encouraging. The company discovered in January that over 600 million user passwords were stored in plain text. It admitted back in November that it was handing over phone numbers that users provided for two-factor security checking to third parties. The FTC confirmed last week that it is once again investigating Facebook after the company admitted it let Cambridge Analytica access users' information in order to target Trump supporters during the 2016 presidential election. But consumers probably shouldn't get their hopes up. FTC's last probe into Facebook privacy practices back in 2011 still led us to where we are now. Would you give a company your very personal data that says it is their moral responsibility to give that data to the FBI? Hell no, at least not willingly know it. Well, the leading DNA testing companies are Ancestry DNA, MyHeritage, FamilyTree DNA, 23andMe, and Living DNA. And one of them, FamilyTree DNA, an Ancestry testing company, says it is their moral responsibility to give the FBI access to your DNA. A popular DNA testing company seems to be targeting true crime fans with a new pitch to let them share their genetic information with law enforcement so cops can catch violent criminals. 2 months ago, FamilyTree DNA raised privacy concerns after BuzzFeed revealed the company had partnered with the FBI and given the agency access to the genealogy database. Law enforcement's use of the DNA database has been widely known since last April, when California officials revealed genealogy website information was instrumental in determining the identity of the Golden State Killer. But in that case, detectives used publicly shared raw genetic data on GEDmatch. The recent news about FamilyTree DNA marked the first known time a home DNA test company had willingly shared private genetic information with law enforcement. Several weeks later, FamilyTree DNA changed their rules to allow customers to block the FBI from accessing their information. Users now have the ability to opt out of matching with DNA relatives whose accounts are flagged as being created to identify the remains of a deceased individual or perpetrator of a homicide or sexual assault, the company said in a statement at the time. Hey, it should not be opt-out, it should be opt-in. Can't they get it right? But now the company seems to be embracing this partnership with law enforcement with a new campaign called Families Want Answers. The company plans to air a new advertisement in San Francisco that features Ed Smart, father of Elizabeth Smart, who was abducted in 2002 and held captive for 9 months before being rescued. In the ad, Ed Smart makes a plea for people to share the DNA so they can help families who have lost a child. When a loved one is a victim of a violent crime, Families Want Answers, he says, as the ad shows footage of a child's shoe on a playground, crime scene tape, and parents embracing. There is more DNA available at crime scenes than any other evidence. If you are one of the millions of people who have taken a DNA test, your help can provide the missing link. Family Tree DNA did not immediately respond to a request for comment on whether the new ad campaign was a response to recent reporting on the company's arrangement with the FBI. In a public statement, Family Tree DNA's president and founder, Bennett Greenspan, seemed to appeal to both genealogy, hobbyists, and true crime fans. The genealogy community has the ability to crowdsource crime solving. If Family Tree DNA can help prevent violent crimes, save lives, or bring closure to family, then they feel justified and the company has a moral responsibility to do so. The press release states that the company's terms of service only allow law enforcement to receive private customer information through a valid legal process such as a subpoena or a search warrant. Family Tree DNA users may have a moral responsibility to decide if they want to opt out of sharing their data with law enforcement or risk having their DNA narc on them or their family members. Well, I can see the value of this information, but it should be an opt-in, definitely not an opt-out. For most people, when they use a service, they don't even realize that it's being used. Or, what you do is before you sell the service, make sure they check the box that they understand that it is an opt-out and the feature is built in. Have you been concerned about the impact of screen time, which is the television, the smart TV, the computer, the tablet, the smartphone? What impact it has on the teen well-being? Well, a study by Oxford University finds that screen time, even before the bedtime, has little impact on teen well-being. Oxford University academics have found little evidence of a relationship between screen time and well-being in adolescence, based on data from more than 17,000 teenagers. The study cast doubt on the widely accepted notion that spending time online, gaming, or watching TV, especially before bedtime, can damage young people's mental health. Research at the University of Oxford found that implementing best practice statistical and methodological techniques, they found little evidence for substantial negative associations between digital screen engagement and adolescent well-being. Analyzing three different data sets, which include improved measurements of screen time, they found little clear-cut evidence that screen time decreases adolescent well-being, even if the use of digital technology occurs directly before bedtime. The research found that adolescents' total screen time per day had little impact on their mental health, both on weekends and weekdays. It also found that the use of digital screens 2 hours, 1 hour, or 30 minutes before bedtime did not have clear associations with decreases in adolescents' well-being, even though this is often taken as a fact by media reports and public debates. Unlike other studies, the Oxford research analyzed data from Ireland, the United States, and the United Kingdom to support its conclusions. The researchers used a more rigorous methodology to gather how much time an adolescent spends on screens per day, including both self-reported measures and time use diaries. This is important as many studies investigating adolescent digital technology use are unreliable. They are based solely on self-reported digital technology use even though recent work found only one-third of participants give accurate accounts of how much time they spend online when asked after the fact. Additionally, the study required the researchers to provide detail of how they were going to analyze the data before it was released. This prevents hypothesizing after the results are known. The study used data from Ireland, the United States, and the United Kingdom. In Ireland, it covered 5,363 young people tracked under the Growing Up in Ireland project. In the United States, the data covered 709 subjects of a variety of ages, compiled by the United States Panel Study of Income Dynamics. And in the United Kingdom, the data set included responses from 11,884 adolescents and their caregivers surveyed as part of the Millennium Cohort Study. What a surprise! Windows Defender was first released in Windows XP as an anti-malware component. Over the years, it has evolved and now renamed Windows Defender Anti-Threat Protection, as the software has embedded itself deeper into Windows 10 operating system. It will soon be made available on your Mac. The Advanced Threat Protection incarnation extended the functionality for Microsoft 365 customers, adding in detection and exploration over devices and identities, as well as automation to clean up the messes inflicted by miscreants where possible. In February of this year, Microsoft added the Microsoft Threat Experts into the mix to speed up the response to threats. Microsoft Threat Experts is an additional layer of expertise and optics that Microsoft customers can utilize to augment security operations capability as part of Microsoft 365. This new managed threat hunting service in Windows Defender ATP provides proactive hunting prioritization and additional context and insights that further empower security operations centers to identify and respond to threats quickly and accurately. Microsoft Threat Experts enables security operations centers to jumpstart threat investigations by providing context-rich intelligence. In plain English, what they're saying is that Windows Defender ATP now incorporates machine learning and artificial intelligence. This is a lot more than what many of the anti-malware services are providing. According to Microsoft, around 27% of Windows 7 users actually use Windows Defender. The figure rises to 55% of all commercial PCs on Windows 10. Because it's built in, it's always up to date, it's always compatible, and more importantly, it's always compliant with Microsoft interfaces. Windows Defender is far less of a resource hog than the product of certain other vendors, although customers have plenty of choice. A report by Statista put Avast as the number one Windows anti-malware application vendor, followed by Malwarebytes. Malwarebytes also enjoys quite a bit of love in the Apple community. As part of Microsoft's ongoing effort to move beyond Windows with the likes of Microsoft 365, it is extending this protection to other operating systems, starting with macOS. After all, once you're paying for Office, what's a little extra anti-malware between friends? Defender has been built into the operating system for a while now. It's constantly monitoring the configuration and the settings of the device, and when it sees that there is anything that is known threat or a known vulnerability that is exposed, it automatically brings that to your attention, and you can take the automated action on that to clean it. According to Microsoft, it is just diagnostic data that allows them to make sure that they're giving the direction to take action. Weary, perhaps, of the notoriously litigious world of antivirus, Microsoft stated that the technology would be in addition to the existing partner integrations already available. There were conditions by New York State for its approval of Charter's merger with Time Warner Cable. The key part of the agreement was that Charter was needed to have a minimum number of passings in its build-out. If Charter were to extend its cabling onto a block and no one subscribed to the TV cabling service, Charter would still be credited for the number of potential subscribers, even though there may not have been any subscribers. What is that issue? How does one define a potential subscriber? Well, they couldn't agree on it, and New York State Public State Commission said that Charter was in violation of the agreement, and they asked Charter to remove itself from New York State, but before doing so was to make the necessary arrangements for someone else to take over the operation. There was a deadline on this. The New York State Public Service Commission has now granted Charter's communications another extension last month, giving the company more time to file a plan to remove itself from the state without leaving customers high and dry. The Public Service Commission asked Charter to leave the state last summer after the cable company allegedly failed to meet all the commitments the state required as conditions for its approval of Charter's merger with Time Warner Cable. Those obligations included providing broadband access to underserved parts of the state and preserving a qualified workforce. Spectrum, which is the name of operation used by Charter, also was expected to build out to 36,000 new customers by December 2018 and 145,000 throughout the state by May 2020. Since the original vote to have Charter leave in 2018, Public Service Commission has voted to give Charter multiple deadline extensions. This 30-day extension, the eighth that Spectrum has received in roughly 9 months, has moved the deadline for filing the six-month plan to May 3rd. It also moved the deadline for filing rehearing petitions in connection with the state's original July 27, 2018, to earlier this week. In an order granting the latest extension, the PSC chairman said Charter offered evidence that the company was near a deal with the state. A letter from Charter's counsel about the extension states that the company and the Department of Public Service are working towards an agreement. The parties have made considerable progress, the letter said. They have now exchanged term sheets and reached an agreement on many key issues, and further data analysis is still underway on certain passings under discussion. An additional time will allow the parties an opportunity to fully review the information exchange as well as to convert the term sheet into fuller written agreement. That written agreement will include an agreement on what is a passing and what is eligible to be called passing. When the company builds out service to a utility pole within reach of a new residence, that will count towards the 145,000 passings build-out conditions pursuant to the 2016 merger. A penalty and/or arrangement pursuant to which Charter funds the expansion of broadband access to further customers in addition to those passed pursuant to the build-out condition and an enforceable schedule to complete the remaining build-out work. That's according to that order. Given the framework for settlement, the progress that has been made, as well as Charter's continued obligation to comply with the public service law and regulations, Charter, which runs the Spectrum brand, did not comment further on the proceedings, but it has maintained in previous comments that it has met the commitments required as a part of its merger agreement. And since the merger went through in 2017, Spectrum has reported to the Public Service Commission that it had expanded its network to more than the required amount of homes. According to the state, Charter had missed deadlines for required network buildouts. It also was condemned by the Public Service Commission for alleged false advertisements. The Public Service Commission voted to revoke the company's license to operate in New York State because Charter was deceptive when counting how many houses it had passed by counting extensions in cities and not just rural areas. The PSC has been calling for Charter to be held accountable for its responsibilities since the merger was approved, and it's unacceptable that New York State keeps giving Charter extensions to come up with a plan to leave the state. The Public Service Commission has drawn a red line, and that red line keeps moving. It had been calling for Charter to be held accountable for its responsibilities since the merger was approved. It's unacceptable that New York State keeps giving Charter extensions to come up with their plan to leave the state. If they're not going to leave the state, then let's find out what their commitment is and let's try to hold them to it and have a clear understanding of what has to be done. Using the term passing just doesn't make sense at all. What they should do is define a geographic area that needs to be covered, not by how many structures you pass or how many telephone poles you use. To the Public Service Commission, you drew a red line, and you've yet to clarify what it is, and Charter, you should be held accountable to explain what have you done to meet the requirements. And there have been many complaints about Charter or Spectrum about its service. So far, what we need is a strong commitment on what areas are to be covered instead of fooling around with telephone poles and passings and all the other things that just makes it so difficult to define. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell, where he's going to talk about SaaS, Software as a Service. This is where many software publishers is changing the business model. Instead of a one-time charge so that you can use the software, they're converting into a monthly charge.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and I am here to give you some benefit from my experience of being an IT professional for a very long time. This week, I'm going to explore this entire concept of as a service. Now, it's usually preceded by something like software as a service, SaaS, software as a service. And there are a number of different layers to this. So I wanted to give you just a brief overview. In the future, we'll get into a little bit more of the weeds. We'll start talking about the individualized items that make up infrastructure as a service, IaaS, platform as a service, PaaS, and the most common one that we hear these days, software as a service, again, SaaS. There are a number of other different related items, but I wanted to give you just a brief idea of what they're doing here. And what that is they're breaking this down and doing this in a number of different ways, which relieves the load from your IT department. It means that a lot of this stuff is being done out of house. It's being done in what we call the cloud. And the cloud really is nothing more than just, instead of it's being your own computers, this is somebody else's computers. And yes, you do pay for that, most likely, at least in the business world. So originally, we did everything on site. We did all of this, every single little bit of computing for the business was done on site, whether we were talking about the file servers sitting around, whether we were talking about the printing, whether we were talking about coding, development. Sometimes we would bring in a software package that was pre-built, but it was all basically managed in-house. Somebody was sitting there in-house. Now, lately, we've been able to make inroads towards taking advantage of the idea of one person in-house and one person outside of house. That one person in-house was actually on the payroll for the company internally, and that external person was providing just a little bit more service. Fortunately, they were providing a little bit more service for your company and somebody else's company and somebody else's company and somebody else's company and so forth. I'll break that all down here in just a moment. Don't get hung up here on one person in-house and one person out-of-house. There could be 20 people in-house and 5 people out-of-house, or the other way around. It's just a matter of providing services on a regular basis more efficiently and also more along the lines of a 24/7 service. So let's back up. I'm going to throw something at you, a little bit of a different idea of pizza as a service. All right. So pizza as a service would be done like this. Originally, way back when, our Italian grandmama, I don't know what the word is for grandma off in Italian, but you get the idea. She was there and she would be in the kitchen and she would have the gas lines coming in, or maybe even doing it with wood, but it would go into the oven. She would have the oven. She would actually go forward and she would make the pizza dough right there. And then she'd sprinkle all of the toppings on, and then she would cook the pizza. This is end-to-end, all homemade pizza. It's made in-house. That's how we did all of the computer stuff way back when. Now, imagine instead of that, to save money, to not have to buy that really expensive, outfitting a kitchen and buying that expensive brick oven and, providing all of the wood there just to make one pizza. Instead, you could go to something that is kitchen as a service. This is something like infrastructure as a service. And we'll get into a little bit more of those details later, but this would be kitchen as a service where somebody provides the kitchen, the gas, and the oven, and then you would go in and you'd make the pizza dough, and then you'd make the toppings, you'd put all the toppings on the pizza, you'd cook it, great, it's all done, wonderful. Okay, we're getting there, but pizza dough, you've got to do a lot of kneading, you got to throw it right, there's a certain skill involved with this. This is not something that people just go on off and they say, oh, hey, I'm going to throw the flour there, the water, and whatever else that I'm going to throw into the pizza dough, and I'm just going to make it. No, you got to do it right. You've got to have somebody who's really good at this. So we wind up with something that's more of like walk in and bake. So somebody, a professional company, is providing the kitchen, the gas, the oven, and the pizza dough. This is going to make it pretty good for you. And then you can put on whatever toppings that you want. And then you cook the pizza. So you walk in and you bake it. It's almost like those pizza joints where, yes, somebody's already provided all of this stuff. And then you go in and you go, yeah, let me have you put on a little bit more pepperoni. Yes. And lots of those green peppers, whatever it is. And then we go that next level over where it's pizza as a service, truly pizza as a service, where somebody is doing the entire handling of everything. They're providing the kitchen, the gas, the oven. They're doing the pizza dough, the toppings, cook the pizza, and you order online. And it's all done just how it's done, and then it gets delivered to you. So that would be software as a service. So you can see that it's just a matter of just different layers are being handled in-house, and some layers are being handled out-of-house. I will dive deeper in coming weeks to give you more of an idea of how this all works for, yes, where you work, or, yeah, for your own home use. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Tax Day 2019. When is the last day to file taxes? Most taxpayers must file federal income tax returns by April the 15th. However, there are some exceptions to the familiar tax filing deadline. Most Americans must file their federal tax returns for 2018 by April 15, 2019. Note, most Americans, but taxpayers in two states have until April 17 to file their 2018 tax returns. And here's why residents of those states get two extra days to submit their 1040s to the IRS. Patriots Day, an official holiday in Maine and Massachusetts that commemorates Revolutionary War battles, falls on April the 15th this year. Normally, residents of those two states would get an extra day to file taxes. However, April 16th is Emancipation Day in the District of Columbia. The holiday honors the end of slavery in Washington, D.C. Since April 16th is a legal holiday in Washington, D.C., and the IRS can't require that tax returns be filed on a legal holiday, taxpayers in Maine and Massachusetts get yet another extra day to file. No matter which state you live in, if for some reason you can't file your federal tax returns on time, you can get an automatic 6-month extension if you file IRS Form 4868 before April 15th, or April 17th if you live in Maine or Massachusetts. You can also get an automatic extension by making an electronic tax payment by the due date. Keep in mind, however, that an extension to file doesn't extend the time to pay your taxes. If you don't pay up by the original due date, you'll owe interest on the unpaid tax. You could also be hit with additional penalties for filing and paying late. If help is needed, free tax preparation services for taxpayers are available. Free assistance in the preparation of income tax returns is available for taxpayers through VITA, that's V-I-T-A, and TCE. The Volunteer Income Tax Assistance, which is VITA, is for individuals of low to moderate income, individuals with disabilities, and non-English-speaking taxpayers. Tax Counseling for the Elderly, or TCE, is for individuals 60 years of age or older. These sites are staffed by volunteers who are trained to prepare both federal and tax returns. Many of these sites prepare tax returns on computers and use electronic filing. Electronic filing, or e-filing, is quick and accurate and allows for faster processing than filing a paper return. VITA sites also offers assistance in filing for federal and state income tax credits, that's EITC, for those who qualify for these benefits. During the tax season, you can find a VITA site near you by calling the IRS at 1-800-906-9887. Let me repeat that. 1-800-906-9887. For an AARP TCE site near you, you can access the website for the tax aid program, or you can call the National AARP office at 1-888-AARP-NOW. Let me repeat that. It's 1-888-AARP-NOW. The IRS Volunteer Income Tax Assistance, VITA, and the Tax Counseling for the Elderly, TCE, programs offer free tax help for taxpayers who qualify. The Tax Counseling for the Elderly, that's TCE, program offers free tax help to individuals who are age 60 or older. Cooperative grant agreements are entered into between IRS and eligible organizations to provide tax assistance to elderly taxpayers. The funds provided by the IRS are used by organizations to reimburse volunteers for their out-of-pocket expenses, including transportation, meals, and other expenses incurred by them in providing tax counseling assistance at locations convenient to the taxpayers. Tax return preparation assistance is provided to the elderly during the normal period for filing federal income tax returns, which is from January 1 to April 15 each year. However, the program activities required to make sure elderly taxpayers receive efficient and quality tax assistance can be conducted year-round. The sponsors are responsible for all aspects of operating the TCE program, including but not limited to publicity, recruitment, training, site selection, and management of volunteers. Section 163 of the Revenue Act of 1978, Public Law Number 95-600-92, Statute 2810, dated November 6, 1978, authorizes IRS to enter into cooperative agreements. Free tax return preparation for qualifying taxpayers. The Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, that's VITA, offers free tax help to people who generally make $55,000 or less, persons with disabilities, and limited English-speaking taxpayers who need assistance preparing their own tax returns. IRS-certified volunteers provide free basic income tax preparation with electronic filing to qualified individuals. In addition to VITA, the Tax Counseling for the Elderly program offers free tax help for all taxpayers, particularly those who are 60 years of age and older, specializing in questions about pensions and retirements-related issues unique to seniors. The IRS-certified volunteers who provide tax counseling are often retired individuals with nonprofit organizations that receive grants from the IRS. Before going to a VITA or TCEA site, see publication 3676-B for services provided and check out what to bring to ensure that you have all the required documents and information that volunteers will need to help you. Note, available services can vary at each site due to the availability of volunteers certified with the tax law expertise required for your return. Check back regularly if the locator does not show a site near you. Most IRS, VITA, and TCE sites are open from February through April, though some are open through October. What if you want to do your own tax preparation, but you don't want to invest in the necessary cost for a tax preparation program to run on a computer, or you don't have a computer? At select tax sites, taxpayers also have an option to prepare their own basic federal and state tax return for free using web-based tax preparation software with an IRS-certified volunteer to help guide you through the process. This option is only available at locations that list self-prep in the site listing. Marty Winston has owned scores of computers, and no matter what he did to prevent it, they all tend to turn into breeding farms for dust bunnies. He's used brooms, vacuums, filter gizmos, you name it, he's tried it. But there's one thing he hasn't done yet. Hey, Marty, take a deep breath, suck it up, and blow out all that hot air that you have, and that may clean up all that dust.
Giving dust the dust off is hard. It's not that the dust you remove comes back. It's that there's so much dust everywhere, you end up just cleaning a place for the new dust to go. Sometimes I think that I could set off an H-bomb in my office and it might incinerate all the dust, but by the time the dust cleared, the dust wouldn't clear. It would just settle back to where the old dust had been. I'm tired of it. I've used vacuums to suck it up, blowers to blow it off, mop things to trap it, and it just won't stop being there. And it isn't just dust. We have a dog and a cat, which makes it an even more hairy problem. So I decided to look into whole house air cleaning. Whether whole house or room by room, I'm only seeing three approaches. One is a fan to circulate air through a filter. One does ionic air cleaning with high voltage wires and ozone to make dust tidbits cluster until they're heavy enough to drop out of the air. And one uses electrostatics to drive dusty air into charge filters that trap it. The whole house gear mounts in your HVAC system, where the cold air return comes into the main box, the main blower box. If you think about it, that's exactly where disposable furnace filters always went. Really, those old filters were the original whole house air cleaners, but even if you never forget to change them on time, you still get a lot of dust. One of the reasons is the bottom of your foot. It works like a piston, and with every step you take, it pumps air downward into the floor, causing the dust that's there to scatter. It billows outward. Want to guess another big dust blower? It's your vacuum cleaner, busy blowing out every bit as much air as it's drawing in. Sure, it picks up some dust, but it can scatter even more. So, come to think of it, that cold air return idea is kind of interesting. Whenever the central air handler's fan is running, it's drawing air into those returns and dust along with it. So, the trick is to not let the dust make a round trip and come out with the heated or cooled air that's getting blown into the room. I want to add something important to that. Think of that as breathing. And remember, the easier the breathing for your HVAC system, the less energy it needs to do its job, and the less wear and tear it has to endure, meaning things run longer before they need repairs. Two and two, you can add it up. Too many filters or too severe a filter may catch more dust, but can also cost you a lot of money. Some whole house air cleaners are just arrangements of multiple filters, sometimes with the addition of a booster fan. They'll trap stuff, and as they do, they'll gradually get clogged up. Among all of the whole house approaches I've seen, they need the most babysitting, the most frequent attention to filter swaps. Do you remember the Sharper Image Ionic Breeze? If I remember right, it had two wires inside that charged the air around them into creating a specific ion of oxygen called ozone. Oxygen is O2 and ozone is O3. I'll skip the details, but it was very good at neutralizing odors and trapping dust. Every couple of weeks, I had to unplug it and flip it so beads on its wires could slide up and down and knock some of the dust off that they collected, and I had to use a rag to wipe the dust off of its internal blades. I wasn't worried about the ozone because I checked, and it was within safety standards. Today, some whole house air cleaners use different configurations, but that same basic technology. A few let you remove their elements from manual cleaning, but most want you to replace those elements, partly because a lot of people doing manual cleaning tend to break the wires. It needs less frequent maintenance than the passive filter arrays, but there's still some babysitting to do, and the replacement elements, well, they cost a lot more than those old furnace filters. And you can still smell the ozone. There's a third approach that also uses high voltages and also creates a little ozone, far less than the ionic tech, but some. This approach uses electrostatic charging of a large area filter, kind of a honey trap for dust. That filter's bigger area helps keep it from clogging or getting coated as much as the other two approaches. There's still something to replace, but for most homes, that's a once-a-year activity. I went over these three technologies: filtering, ionic attraction, and electrostatic entrapment. I went over them in this order because it also represents the span of least expensive to most expensive. As you might guess, I like the electrostatic option. Some people run their HVAC system fan full-time, all the time, to keep cycling air through their electrostatic cleaners. Some people set that fan to run at least 30 minutes every hour, whether or not the HVAC is heating or cooling. And I have to say, that's a good way to keep mixing the air in the house so the thermostat isn't dealing with only right there temperature information. Some people use that half-the-hour approach automatically, but turn on a 3-hour cleaning cycle when they vacuum to gather the dust that the vacuum stirs up, picks up, and throws into the air. I'm not sure what to suggest for people with robot vacuums. And you know, it's still a good idea to have your ducts cleaned, certainly before you install a whole house air cleaner, and maybe checked when the duct people suggest they should be due again. Now, if you have somebody in your house with bad allergies and you try a good whole house cleaner and they still have troubles, it's absolutely okay to add a more severe, maybe HEPA-style, in-room air cleaner. At least it will have less work to do. Next time, I'll be telling you about pickle brine and sugar beets and people who blow snow in their own faces. You're invited to join me for that.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Tri-State region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. Computer Learning Center at Ewing. They'll have a presentation on Apple Seeds, Apple Devices, Thursday, April 11th. Meeting time is 2 p.m., and it's at the Ewing Senior and Community Center, 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. New York Amateur Computer Club will have its presentation of Back to the Future. The DOS dossier is alive and well, And I'll be giving that presentation, and I'll be talking about some of the hidden run and DOS commands in Windows. Thursday, April the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU at 102 Maya Hall, located at 4 Washington Place. This is a temporary meeting location. That's 102 Maya Hall, 4 Washington Place in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have their meeting on Friday, April the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Harold J. Schurer Hall, New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus in Old Westbury, New York. Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, April the 23rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on Wi-Fi 6 IEEE 802.11ax and what does the future hold. Thursday, April the 25th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will have their meeting on May the 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their meeting on Friday, May 3rd. Meeting time is 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will meet Tuesday, May the 7th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they meet at the Danbury Hackerspace at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. The Kings Byte Computer Club will meet Tuesday, May the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Park Plaza Restaurant at 220 Cadman Plaza West, Brooklyn, New York. If you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and podcasts are available from all major pod hosting sites, as well as on our website, pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us or commentary on any of our feature segments, just send us your email address with your telephone number, in which we can call you at a convenient hour for playback on the program. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember to back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.